Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2019. This is the penultimate night, or the penultimate night, I believe. So this is the last full night, though. We have four streams coming up. Later on, Blackpilled, The After Party, and then Nightmares, Rogue Drones. But first, Libertas Metapolitics. So he was on last year. And then I did a stream with them, I think, in early, like January or February this year on the live channel. So I like him very much, intelligent young English guy. So welcome back, Libertas Metapolitics, to Millennial.
Thanks very much, Rose. Nice to be on. Nice to be on again for the second time. Hope everyone's had a good Christmas. And yeah, looking forward to the new year.
Yes, excellent. All right, so I guess I'm just distracted by a rather amusing comment that somebody's just posted. Woz has accidentally plugged a cigarette into his computer's USB for the camera and plugged the camera into the synth again. Thank you for that show of faith. All right. So with that said, let's get into it. So what would you want to talk about this decade, the 2010s, which has another 3 days left only. So we are approaching the end of this decade, so what would you like to say about it?
Yeah, well, always when you come up to the new year, it's kind of a time for reflection and looking back on the past year, and particularly as we're coming up to the end of this decade, it feels like this has been such a big decade, particularly on the kind of dissident right. For many of us, it's been a kind of the birth of the entire movement has been in the last decade. So a lot of people,
yes, see I don't know what I was even aware of prior to 2010. I think I first became aware of it as such around about that time. There was Robert Stark, I think in 2010, 2011, maybe 2012. I first started listening to his recordings, and it was interviews with Richard Spencer and Greg Johnson around that time. But definitely in the 2000s, I was just counter jihad sort of thing, you know, that and moaning, you know, like sort of paleocon moaning about the state of the world. That was all there really was. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no. Well, I've been my sort of political background is very normie. I used to be heavily involved in the Conservative Party, the kind of Conservative Future in the UK. And yeah, it really seems like over the past 10 years, but particularly in the latter half of the last decade, there's been a real big upswing in this kind of dissident thinking, a movement away from the traditional kind of left-right paradigms. And so, yeah, I've been thinking a lot about the kind of last decade and how we've arrived at this position. And I think it's almost like we're seeing now the kind of symptoms presenting themselves of having institutions that are saturated with the kind of 1968er New Left movement. And I mean, for example, in Britain, in the UK, we often think of the New Labour era as being a kind of watershed government.
Now, that's just for everyone's edification. That's 1997 to 2010.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, this is kind of what I've been thinking about, like how does it break down in terms of like the turn of the millennium, and then you know, the various cohorts you've got and where they would be in life at different stages and different times. So we often think of the New Labour government, the New Labour era, as being this kind of watershed government, because they're the ones who rub the right's nose in diversity. They're the ones who really make a kind of concerted effort to radically change the demographics of the UK. And they kind of create the whole culture of political correctness and the New Left inspired thought.
It did exist prior to that. I remember on the mid 90s, maybe even the early 90s, on some news show, seeing a guy using the term politically correct nonsense. So obviously the concept of political correct, I don't know when it was born. I don't know when that term was first. I mean, I think it might have come from Soviet. I've got a feeling it actually came out in the first place from Soviet Russia. But in our, to mean what we mean it, I think it must have been born in the 80s, but I'm not sure. That might be naive of me. Anyway, New Labour, you say, I think it was, people were aware of it in Britain as a thing, but obviously New Labour was a watershed, and that was the first time, because for those 18 years before that, it was the Tories, first Thatcher, then John Major. And even though the culture was pushing in a PC direction. The government was still a bit crusty, conservative, old-fashioned, and so on. So New Labour, I mean, I remember when it emerged and it was this cool Britannia, of course. And Tony Blair had been into rock music, he'd played the guitar, you know, that... incredibly naff.
Just call me Tony.
Yeah, exactly, that kind of thing. And on the couch with having relaxed and formal discussions. Yeah. Anyway, it's all
because they kind of...
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, they kind of abandoned the economic ground, seeing that as sort of short term, because you're in this, they coast along with this kind of post-Thatcherite neoliberal policy on the economic side of things, in order to secure far more radical changes in the social arena.
Exactly.
Which is what they did, you know.
Well, this is what we see now. What is often termed globalism, where it's effectively right-wing economics with a welfare state, but it's right-wing economics, the pro-business, pro-corporate, pro-big business, but then extraordinarily liberal, progressive in the social sphere. But what I wanted to say about New Labour was they not only brought in mass immigration as for real. I mean, it had been going on up till then, but they hugely increased it. But they also brought in a change in the culture. Political correctness really became a thing in the New Labour era, 97 to 2010, the Equalities Act, and that kind of stuff. So it definitely attended the New Labour government. It was the New Labour government that brought all of that stuff in.
Yeah, and I was thinking about it in terms of the kind of timeline, because it actually makes perfect sense if you think of the different cohorts. So the average age of an MP in the UK is 50. Blair won his first election in 1997. So a 50-year-old in 1997, the average age of an MP, they would have been 21 in 1968. So this was the kind of cohort that was right in the middle of their degrees while this student movement was going on. Those people who all swept into power in 1997, and it wasn't just the MPs, it was then the people they put into positions of power throughout our institutions, civil servants and so on. Those were the people who had initiated the kind of new left, postmodernist inspired rebellion against traditional authority back in the 60s. And so you have a kind of like 1997 to 2010 can be almost thought of an exposure period to the kind of radiation of these bad ideas. And now the last 10 years, we're really seeing this underlying sickness of ideology presenting its symptoms now.
Exactly.
And people are starting to notice.
Those people I would say that a lot of the New Labour people are really in, it was in the 70s that they were students, like, what's her name? Harriet Harman. They were late 60s through to the 70s. That's when they were students, and that's where they were imbibing second wave feminism and, of course, the very beginnings of multiculturalism as an idea, a thought-out concept, not just a de facto reality. So they came of age and they were first in power with the New Labour government. And what's happened, as you say, since 2010 is that they have then created that generation who came of age, who were shaped, formed in the late 60s and 70s, are in positions of power from the late 90s onwards or before that. And they have now shaped a new generation. And that's what we call the SJWs. They are the third wave feminists, the absolute nutcases, the progressives, and so forth. And yeah, so you take it from there.
Yeah, well, they've saturated all the institutions and created this kind of culture. And I think the real crux of kind of new left ideas is a culture of repudiation. So it attacks everything, and it's kind of vampiric in that it feeds off the attacks. It attacks, you know, all our narratives, all our traditions, all ideals. And the problem is it creates a kind of listlessness in society. There's no real direction. And I think there's a kind of rebellion against that that's come about from the distant right. It's a kind of looking for new ideals. Because I'm sure anybody who's done, anybody who's listening, who's done kind of politics type subjects in the UK or anything to do with that, will have had the experience of a kind of smug professor or smug teacher, you know, saying, oh, well, you know, the British did this, that's bad as well. And you get the feeling going through academia that the whole thing is this kind of fanatical search for the fly in the ointment of everything we know or value. You know, it's like all our traditions, all our cultures, all our narratives, anything that we would create a value system from. It's like looking for the fly in the ointment of that as a reason to write it all off. And there's this kind of, and in a kind of like smug sense. But yeah, it creates directionlessness in society.
Yeah, you end up with the only thing that you're left to believe in that isn't explicitly far left is the market, consumerism, being a consumer. Mm. And indeed, I would say that the centrists like Sargon completely fall for this, where they think that, well, what does anyone really need other than money, a job, and you know, just stuff to consume, stuff to do. And it's a very empty, from my point of view, this is a dreadfully empty, shallow existence.
Yeah, right. It's all about widget production. And I think that's the other thing is that it's, in kind of the wake of that is you've got this entrenched now position of the new left. I would say they've kind of taken the fortress, and there's a rebellion against the empirical presentation of, you know, this is the kind of society that these ideas create. We're now seeing a multicultural society, and a lot of people don't like it. They don't see it as actually being empirically good. Utopia has not arrived as it was promised. And so the last 10 years on the intellectual side of things, I think a lot of people are interested in trying to discover new paradigms. That's why we've, and you just said about sort of the neoliberal economics being the only thing in opposition to the new left. And that's true as well. I think that's why the last 10 years has potentially, or could perhaps be said to be characterized by a search for new paradigms. So we're moving away from traditional left-right, because traditional left-right is presented to us as a false dichotomy choice between the kind of Thatcherite right-wing economics and then the kind of new left social liberal SJW leftism. And I think that's where you've got this now turn to people looking for new paradigms. You've got globalism versus nationalism. You've got all these kind of new paradigms coming out. I think one that's quite interesting is, and then there's obviously liberal versus authoritarian, but I think an interesting one is inclusivity versus exclusivity. There's a kind of pathological inclusivity which has come about on the left, and just in the culture across all politics is a kind of pathological inclusivity. And this kind of John Lennonism, love everybody, love all the people, that goes hand in hand with globalism. But the problem is it ends up being antithetical to all the things that they purport to believe in. So, you know, love, for example, love or respect. You should love everyone, you should respect everyone. But when you apply like an insane leveling of inclusivity to that, you lose the very thing you were trying to create. So love, for example, well, there are 7 billion people in the world. You couldn't even, you know, if both of us now started trying to write everybody's name down in the world, we wouldn't even make it a fraction of the way through before we died. We wouldn't know anything about any of those people. We would just have written their name down. So you couldn't possibly love all the people. Love is inherently an exclusive thing, as is respect, and all these virtues that used to be valued are actually quite exclusive. And so I think, you know, that's one of the things that modernity and this kind of new left thinking really creates a problem with, is that all these things that are actually meaningful and valuable, when you extend it to everybody and you say, you know, you have to care for everybody and you can't draw any boundaries or borders, you kind of destroy everything inside, you know?
Oh, well, of course. This is, I think, if you were to sort of boil it all down to one sentence, you could say that what has emerged in the last 10 years is the utter emptiness that is left once you get rid of all values, once you get rid of all categories and hierarchies. You're effectively just leaving people as atoms. You're just treating them as animals and leaving them to the fate of the market. I mean, the only paradigm, the only sort of social doctrine that is allowed is progressivism, or you can have a few objections to progressivism. That's it.
yeah, that like, you know, it's like Piers Morgan in the UK. He drives me mad. He's my because he always has this thing where he'll bring on, like you say, progressivism or a few objections. So he'll bring on someone who's like stark raving leftist, and then he's kind of the voice of reason by being slightly opposed to that. So, you know, someone who believes in a million genders, and he'll go, you know, oh, well, it's fine to be, you know, being transgendered, that's like, that's fine. That's not a mental illness. It should be encouraged and da 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 da. But come on, like a million genders, really? Surely there's only 1,000. And it's like, you know, he's the voice of reason, but really?
Yeah. What he would probably not realize is that even by entertaining this, you're saying that these are legitimate genders. It's your entire attitude. I mean, I'm not saying that you should even deny that there are people who genuinely are transgendered. I think there are. But it's the way you approach it is so crucial, because if you approach it with a mind to accommodating it, you give an inch, it'll take a mile.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a huge difference between acknowledging the existence of something and having compassion for the people who find themselves in that situation, and then encouraging that situation as a societal norm. That's a massive difference. And that's what you see nowadays, is that, you know, things like being homosexual, transgendered, or things like this are pushed not only as being tolerated, or, you know, these are people who we should have compassion for or something like that, but it's this should be actually a norm that should be encouraged, for example, in education and so on and so forth. This is totally normal, when really, you know, all kind of biology and traditions point to the fact that it's not. And so you kind of have to lie to yourself all the time. You're asked to lie to yourself all the time in this kind of new society under a system of political correctness. You're asked to lie to yourself all the time.
Well, I mean, there's a famous quote from Theodore Dalrymple that various people throw around a lot about political correctness, how it is essentially institutionalized lying and enforced lying. And he made the point that I'm not sure I agree with, that the very purpose of PC is to humiliate people by forcing them to go along with a lie. I'm not sure about that. I think it's more just about confusing people, making them malleable in that way.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting when we talk about these kind of things, and then you see, because that's obviously one of the other things that's been huge over the past 10 years, is the internet and the bringing together of like different communities and different people to kind of discuss these ideas together, and also memes. So political correctness is, I think, there's something about being politically correct and how that stands in opposition to the internet, because the internet has this kind of culture of irony and memes and joking. And political correctness, on the other hand, likes to be, or it needs to be taken seriously. You know, everybody takes political correctness very seriously. And,
well, you said that the internet has a culture of memes and irony and all that. I'd say more broadly than that, the internet enables dissent in a way that normal life just simply doesn't. And this is why, I mean, you can have any community you want on the internet. You can. And once upon a time, you could say anything you wanted on the internet, but in normal life, you can't. And that, I think, this is probably a big thing for Generation Z, but also for the millennials. I mean, the internet sort of arrived when I was 12, and thereafter, we simply grew up with it as a very different space from normal life. Like, there are things you can't say in normal life, but you can say them on the internet because everyone's anonymous. But also that meant that people started to expect that on a web forum or whatever, it wasn't like normal life. So you didn't expect people to be shocked by things. Whereas if you know that if you said a particular thing in the pub or at a dinner party or to your family or whatever, they would be shocked. But there was an expectation, understanding that the internet is more of a free speech zone for everyone up until maybe 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, let's say, when it started, that started to rapidly change.
Yeah, well, because I suppose because the ideas are kind of detached from yourself, it's like you can play devil's advocate or can more play with ideas and concepts, and but also form these communities. I mean, that's one of the really interesting things about the last 10 years, particularly the last 5 years, is that, as you know, I generally describe myself as a nationalist, but there's definitely becoming a kind of global element to nationalism now, through the internet. So, you know, we all cheer for, I mean, like I said, the genesis for a lot of people in this movement was the kind of 2016 Trump election that brought a lot of people into kind of caring more about these, about what was going on and the kind of paradigm shift that was happening with Trump standing against Hillary, and whether these were two kind of visions for the future, and where these different directions headed. And I think that brought a lot of people on board, but it brought a lot of people on board from Europe as well, because it seemed that we faced the same problems, and we were united on the internet to discuss these problems, because essentially what you're talking about, and what you could also say the past 10 years is a kind of rise of existential politics, in that we now see the meaning of our politics or our political positions, not just about like a slightly higher quality of living or this or that, but it's a kind of for the very existence of our civilization. So, you know, if these particular trends continue, then there's going to be radical changes. It's not just about, you know, making things slightly more one way or another. It feels like the stakes have changed perhaps in the past 10 years.
Oh, definitely. I think that, I mean, 10 years ago, you could say, okay, there's this thing called political correctness, and it's a bit out of control, but I have faith that our politicians are on our side, and they just want normality as well. Yes, the naive could still believe that.
Mm.
Nowadays, I don't think that, for all sorts of reasons, I think that you couldn't believe that anymore if you had your eyes open. I mean, this is why, although I'm obviously pleased about that Brexit's going to happen, you know, I find it very hard to get excited about the general election results. And I don't want to depress everyone. So, you know, but I do think, look, Boris Johnson is not on our side. Not even like yours and mine as nationalists. He's not on the British people's side. So, you know, there's a lot left to do yet.
I mean,
the point is, I think that it became clear in this decade just how crazy, how unnatural and perverse the plan is for us.
Yeah, I'm no fan of the Conservative Party. One book I always recommend to people, well, in the UK, is The Cameron Delusion by Peter Hitchens, which is one that goes on about the Conservative Party essentially and all its failings over the past God knows how many years. They've had a lot more governments since the Second World War, than a lot more years in government than the Labour Party has. But most of the changes have kind of happened under their watch, and they routinely betray their kind of base and their, you know, their supporters. So no, it's not really a victory, but I think what you could say is that the Labour Party has now made the kind of a lot of the new left intersectionality side of things, and particularly the kind of anti-white, anti-male, anti-traditional rhetoric, they've really embraced that and made it integral to their platform. And they've been totally rejected by white, yes, working class in the north. So that's something to have hope about.
Yes, indeed. They've overplayed their hand. But I wonder how much... See, this is why referendums are so much more juicy and interesting than general elections. Because with a general election, you have to try to parse out, well, why did they vote against that party? At least with a referendum, you kind of know it's that how they feel about that issue, how the public feel about this issue. With a general election, you've got to try to guess what issue was salient in choosing this party over that party. It's really annoying. So why do you, from your point of view, why did the working class vote against Labour?
Well, Brexit's obviously a major issue, but then Brexit's also a proxy for a whole host of other things. So, you know, certain issues like Brexit to end up being proxy for anti-immigration, and a kind of, I mean, you can look at the voting patterns of different demographics, and I think sadly we are seeing what a lot of us on the dissident right have predicted and are predicting, which is the increased racialization of politics, which never used to be a thing, but it seems like over the past sort of 20, you know, because you do have this demographic issue in elections. So, for example, in the UK, BAME voters vote massively disproportionately for the Labour Party, and they do so because the Labour Party kind of like goes after them and makes them makes this like a particular platform, and they end up, it's funny because the people who are kind of most the parties that end up being or the intersectional leftists who are most claim to be least racist are always the ones that in the long term, through their creation of these different voting blocks along ethnic lines, they're the ones who create the tensions which then lead to our ideas. So, you know, it's like they're Frankenstein and we're the monster or something like that. But this is an inevitable outcome. And I think, like you said, the original question obviously was why did the white working class in the North who traditionally voted Labour, why are they coming out for the Conservatives? Well, I think increasingly they see the Conservatives as the kind of down-to-earth Brexit, traditional white kind of, you know, Shires type party. Whereas London has become, you know, you see like tweets from Ash Sarkar and it's like day one of a Labour government and it's like just rap yeah, video, it's twerking. Awful. It's like, come on, man.
Just awful. I did take pleasure in seeing somebody after the election retweeting that and saying this aged badly. Because of course, things like that probably, I mean, I don't know how many Northern working class people saw that tweet from her, but I mean, it really does put you off. It really does make you think, holy shit, I really hope that Labour don't win this election.
Yeah, but I mean that's one tweet, and that's kind of like a little snapshot of the of their whole emphasis that they've had throughout the last 10 years or so, or 20 years in politics. The left has been constantly pandering to this totally different vision of Britain than most people have, which is a division of you know, kind of like hyper multiculturalism, anti-British, anti-white, anti-Western, anti-traditional, the culture of repudiation. So everything that's good about us, any kind of patriotism, pride in oneself or nation or any of these traditional values, is completely repudiated by the left. And they think that that resonates a lot more with people than it does. And even when it means, you know, picking
the it resonates with BME people demonstrably, but yeah.
Yeah, of course. And that's and then this creates the problem of, you know, if we have, that's why mass immigration becomes such a problem, because it's clear that there's like a replacement plan in terms of the demo, in terms of actual voting blocks. It's like that's it's an electoral strategy. So if they have this electoral strategy to essentially, and you can see this with, you know, the much cited now Robert Putnam study, when he says that essentially when you have mass immigration, the natives see it reduces trust not only between communities but within communities, because natives see other natives as being in cahoots with the new arrivals, and it creates this kind of whole tribal system which Labour is actively making an electoral strategy. So, you know, they're going after these BME voters and kind of doing this rent seeking type, it's rent seeking policy. So it's like, we're going to take money and give it to this group rather than this group, and on no other grounds, you know, as with and it's all inspired by postmodernism thinking, in that there's no kind of universalist vision for the world, there's no universal truth, so it's all about all against all, and this kind of rent-seeking tribalist attribution of distribution of resources. So I mean, it's the kind of thing you see in Africa, like Kenya, for example, where they have 13 different ethnic minorities, and it really hampers their ability to have a democracy, because any time one leader gets in from a particular tribal sect, he reallocates all the infrastructure spending to the area where his tribe lives, and the rest of them can go hang. And now we're seeing that. Well, this happens across Africa, where you have lots of different ethnic groups and people with a kind of tribal heritage and a very strong identity mashed into one nation, is that then anytime a new leader gets in and he's from, you know, Kikuyu or some particular ethnic group, he reallocates all the resources in favor of that small group and taxes the whole nation, and it just creates conflict that we never had, and we had no reason to need to deal with. And I think that's like a big reason why people use words like betrayal, because it's like, we had no reason for this problem. Like, we were fairly homogenous. We had a kind of, you know, we weren't racist. We weren't, we didn't even have to think about this. This wasn't kind of on the agenda, and now you've put it on the agenda, and now we have to deal with all these problems. And they're making central.
See, this is something that annoys me about the centrists. They'll go, well, Britain was never an ethnostate. It was never a white nationalist thing. It didn't need to be. That's the whole fucking point. It didn't need to be because there was it's even safe to say, to state this, why it did. But it was fairly homogenous. Almost, I mean, somebody quoted the other day that in 1951, Britain was 99.7% white. So, it's just so self-explanatory and obvious that it's infuriating that this needs to be explained at all. Why identitarianism or identity politics, white identity, but native identity, it was never there because it was never needed. But as soon as you have the presence of mass numbers of other groups, well, then suddenly it is necessary because otherwise they're going to use identity politics against you. I mean, this is just obvious group dynamics. I cannot believe that this needs to be explained. And I really wonder, does it need to be explained at all, or do people understand this effortlessly and they're just missing the point deliberately? They're just wasting everyone else's fucking time.
Yeah, I honestly, you have to wonder sometimes because it does seem quite obvious. And also that you say about it being homogenous previously, and it was, but also it's a two-pronged attack because at the same time as you've got this dilution of the homogenous native ethnic group, you also have an attack on the strong national identity that made that group cohesive. So, for example, in the UK, there's no ethnic British. We're English, Irish, Scottish, you know, Welsh. And I'm sure there's slight variations in the genetics there. So it's not like it has to be totally pure, but we also had this kind of tradition and this long history and shared history and a kind of a cultural mixture into that, which made us a functioning nation that was able to have a high trust society and all these kind of things. And people say, like, you know, oh, back in the 60s you used to be able to leave your doors unlocked, and it's like, yeah, well, it is true when you have like a high IQ, high trust society, which is fairly homogenous, and everybody kind of gets the culture, everybody gets the customs, everybody gets the social norms, you know, everybody queues, and if you don't queue you get tutted at, and that's like death. Then that works. But when you kind of bring in people from radically different cultures, it breaks the whole system, because then you end up in this kind of individualistic, much more individualistic mindset. You're like, well, if I mean, it's game theory, really. It's like the prisoner's dilemma or something. If you think that other players in the game might renege on the agreement of the game, then you're less likely to play because you worry that other people won't play along. And traditions are essentially like games that have been played over generations, and people know the rules, and so they keep playing. But as soon as a few people stop playing, it ruins the entire game.
Absolutely. It depends on this understanding, this unspoken agreement, that we're not going to screw each other over. And you wouldn't, because you wouldn't screw each other over most of the time, because social protocols would prevent you from doing that. You wouldn't want social shaming. But social shaming can only happen if everyone agrees on the rules, the breaking of which is grounds for shaming somebody. And, well, we can't really agree on the rules anymore. But that, I don't want to get too much into that, because there's an easy answer to that, which is, well, we just have to insist on the rules. And this is what the civic nationalist comes out with. So I think that we have to instead emphasize, the rules have become irrelevant, because it's much deeper than that. It's much deeper than values. Again, I keep thinking about the centrists and the civic nationalists who are still, yeah, they're still stuck in this. It's almost like the 2010s have assaulted these people so much that it's left them just frightened and like a deer in the headlights, and all they can do is pathetically pledge allegiance to the idea of well, the social contract, because they know that something deeper is called for, but they daren't say it. They daren't call for it. So instead, they're sort of defaulting to this thing from 10 years ago, 15 years ago, pathetically hoping that that's going to be enough, but it's not going to be enough because identity politics is going to come and get you.
Yeah, I mean, civic nationalism as well is... I call myself a nationalist, and I think, you know, ethno-nationalist, I don't even like using the word ethno-nationalist, because it's like, that is the default understanding of the word nationalist. If you go and look up the term nation, it's even on Wikipedia or Google definition, it's a fully mobilized and fully fledged ethnic group as a nation. And that's just the term that's always been understood. And civic nationalism is a subversion of that that has never really worked. Like we're seeing the kind of death throes of civic nationalism now. We're seeing the end game of civic nationalism now, and it's not as good as it was under a more homogenous system.
I think you're right about that. And I've been saying for quite a few years that the centrists, Sargon, Jordan Peterson, that kind of thing, are going to be irrelevant 10 years from now unless they get hip to the idea of identity politics for white people. And I stand by it, and I think it's playing out right on time. I think that the Tommy Robinson thing, that demonstrates people who are thinking about these matters are no longer content, at least a large percentage of them, are no longer content with just moaning about Islam. They're realizing that it's much broader and deeper than that. And I think that, and also you can see in Sargon's rhetoric that he's really going for he's calling himself a nationalist, but he means a civic nationalist. And I think that's the start of that transition. They're realizing if I just continue to insist on the rules and claim that identity doesn't matter, I'm going to be a dinosaur. I'm going to be seen as a laughing stock in the near future, and they will be. So what they're doing just now, the compromise they're doing just now, is to say identity does matter, but it's identity based on values.
Yeah, which is
that's just the compromise they're hoping will work, but of course it will not.
Well, values and ideas are so transient and malleable, and also that the only values that are the only values that are kind of ardently enforced by our political leaders are the values of valuelessness. So it's like tolerance and acceptance and always accepting other people's values. There's no positive vision of our own values, so that's nothing to adhere to. But I'd say to people like, you know, you said when we were talking about the rules and the social norms, you said the civic nationalists would say, well, we have to enforce the rules. But the obvious answer to that, or the question to that, is that who's we and where do the rules come from? Because I think civic nationalists often... they're a bit spurgy in that they have this kind of constitutionalist view of all civilization, and that everything can come from the top down, but it just doesn't work like that. I think, you know, we have to enforce the rules. Well, yeah, but we is our, you know, group, our kind of...
But I think it's wrong even to get into the discussion about rules, because it's not really about rules. The rules are just a sort of... The rules of social engagement are just a happy accident, and they emerge from a long history, and... they're easily inculcated in people who are the same, who look like you, who are the same ethnic group as you. It's not really about rules, and you're not going to get a cohesive nation just by insisting on social rules, I don't think. You could get a workable police state by insisting on social rules and then having a police state to enforce those rules. But on its own, it's just not enough, I don't think.
Well, that's the difference, like I say, between top down and bottom up, and that's why I think it's so sad that we're seeing the destruction of what we had in England and the United Kingdom, because we had a system where laws were abided, but they never needed to be enforced necessarily. You know, it's like the law is there, but the law is made by the people who obey it. In that social norms are different to kind of constitutions and top-down models. And I think a lot of libertarians and civic nationalists and this kind of people who see themselves as on the right, but they're not necessarily nationalists. They have this kind of economist's view of the world where they see everything as a model. And like or like a computer programmer's idea of the world where you can input these kind of rules and input these you know, startup system with these certain rules and these parameters and these conditions, and then everybody's just going to be like a unit in this thing that abides by them, and it's all from the top down. The reality is much more organic. It comes from the family.
It's hilarious, as you're saying, like software. It's like install trust, install fair play. But of course, that's not going to work. But recently, I have to say, I've developed a lot of contempt. I mean, I've been exasperated with this kind of stuff for quite a few years now, quite a few years. But in recent times, in recent months, I've really developed contempt for the likes of Douglas Murray, who I see him now as a complete gatekeeper and a shill and a traitor, and a coward, a real fucking coward. And I can't stand how he tries to, by saying something slowly, he makes people think that it's profound. He's and then the interview goes, yes. And I see this in fucking one interview after. I'm sorry to be swearing so much, but it's really pissing me off.
I know exactly what you mean.
These wasters, they're just wasting everyone's time. And so that him in particular, I mean, there are others. He's not the only one, but he's the one who jumps to mind just prances to mind as this utter waste of people's time at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I know exactly what you mean about Douglas Murray and saying stuff slowly. There's quite a funny pickup on him because he's released this new book recently, which I've got to say, I mean, the jury's out on Douglas Murray, because on the one hand, I'd say The Strange Death of Europe for me was a really red-pilling book for me, which got me a lot into kind of down the kind of nationalist path and addressing some of the serious issues that we as a society faced. But at the same time, I think he's another one like Jordan Peterson who says, you know, he's a gatekeeper. So he says, you know, here's a little bit to think. Here's a little bit to think. Okay, well, I think you've had a bit too much to think there, right? You can stop. And that's particularly apparent with his new book. So he's done this, was it Gender, Race, and Identity or something like that? And I read about halfway through, but it's quite, it's just kind of the same sort of, it's kind of right-wing cheerleading. I feel like it's less profound, definitely, than Strange Death of Europe. And he just kind of goes through, it's like, oh, political correctness and, oh, this is crazy. You know, you like talking about the Greendale University, Brett Weinstein and that whole issue. And it's like, if you've been following this stuff, then you kind of know what happened. And he's telling these stories, for the appetite of normies and,
that story is when a bunch of lecturers, a lot of whom aren't really, if you were to look at their early life on Wikipedia, wouldn't really be white, were shocked because they were being treated as white, and their students were suddenly saying that it was a whites are banned from the campus day because it's for people of color. Mm. And you think, well, you know, you built this, you made this happen. So what do you expect? I mean, they're brainwashed against whiteness. And you've been applauding this all this time, letting it happen. And now, you know, Brett Weinstein is shocked to find himself banned from the campus by his own students. Well, you know, the lunatics are taking over the asylum. What did he expect?
Yeah, and it was I think the president or the chairman of the university was locked in got locked by students in his own study, and they've got baseball bats and stuff. And Douglas Murray's there saying like, surely this has gone a bit too far now. Okay, you can stop with the leftism. And he tries to bring attention to this stuff, but it's just like, we know, like, it's blindingly obvious that that's too far. You need to be a bit quicker to kind of like dig into this stuff and say, okay, now what can we do to come back about it? You need to be a little bit more radical than that. Cause he always just kind of, you know, he's like the minesweeper, like he's just putting a little red flag over some of this stuff, but doesn't like kind of draws attention to it, but never really has a cohesive answer to it. And also my problem with him is that he, like you said, he's a gatekeeper, and that now his big thing now is that he said, and he mentions this a lot if you watch some of the interviews that he does for his book tour, is he says, and this is very much like Jordan Peterson, he says, oh yes, well, you know, the left have pushed too far. And now we're seeing this thing where people are reaching for this weapon of IQ. And now people, I've heard, you know, as Douglas Murray says, he says, oh, I've heard people say this to me now in conversation several times, and they're interested in books like The Bell Curve. And, you know, they're bringing out IQ as a reason to justify a pushback against the kind of intersectional BAME, LGBT, lobby. And IQ is coming into this, and he's kind of raising now the red flag against, like, okay, ethno-nationalism's gonna make a comeback. And Jordan Peterson,
we can just skip the IQ thing and go straight to identity if you want, if you'd prefer that, Douglas.
Yeah, well, Jordan Peterson brought attention to this in a Joe Rogan podcast about 4 years ago, 3 years ago, and he said, he kind of lays out the whole postmodernist. He talks about it as a game. So he says, so he lays out the postmodernist game, and he says, well, you know, what's going to happen is if you keep having this intersectional attack on the traditional white male identity and traditional white Western identity, then people are going to say, you know, okay, if it's all against all and that's the game and there's no universal values and there's no universal identity and we're all in our tribes, well, I'm a white man, I'm in my tribe, I'm not going to get all guilty and lose, I'm going to just win, I'm going to play to win. And he said that, but then he also said, well, don't do that because, you know, that'll be bad. So, but realistically,
and this is yeah. why he's such a weak man, ultimately. And, you know, I don't want to pick on him because he's got mental health issues and all that, fine. But he shouldn't be, I mean, he's preaching weakness. That's what I can't forgive about him. He's knowingly, surely he must know how this is going to play out. I mean, if he's as, you know, it doesn't even take that much intelligence. So to know, well, if you don't, I mean, it's the classic thing. I mean, Molyneux put it in a really good way, that if it's two football teams playing against each other, but one team only passes to themselves and the other team passes to any player, then yeah. that team's going to lose.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And you've got to think about his audience as well. So, you know, while I can appreciate the idea that, you know, everything, if he's making the argument that we need to appeal more to universalist ideas on both sides, then fine. But let's be realistic here. His audience is almost entirely young white men, you know, young white men. And so the people he's preaching to are and of a kind of more right wing, more non-SJW, at least, persuasion. And so he's not saying this where, you know, the people listening to him aren't SJWs, and the people listening to Douglas Murray aren't SJWs who are going, oh, well, yeah, no, I'll reel it in a bit, actually. The people listening to him are young white men who are being attacked by this kind of, by this collective, by this coalition of the so-called oppressed who are trying to attack them. And he's saying, well, you can't actually collectivize to fight back. You can't collectivize to defend things that are valuable to you. So your identity, your country, your customs, your history, your nation, all these things that are under attack, that are being repudiated, you're not allowed to actually collectivize under a cohesive identity to defend yourself against these things. But he never seems to really explain why, and other than some sort of abusive reference. Yeah, it's ugly and normally, you know, paired with a kind of abusive reference to fascism or some sort of, you know, 20th century problem or something like that. And it's like, well, okay, but, you know.
I can see the return of the 1930s.
Yeah,
that's how he would approach this issue. Well, and that's like, well, or I think this could get very, very ugly. And then, of course, that's extremely persuasive.
Well, yeah, and that's there's always this just kind of ominous fear. And the truth is, it could get very ugly. But the more it's more ugly, it's more likely to get ugly the longer you leave it. You know, the longer you say, you know, it's like, and Jordan Peterson says this himself, which is another thing that annoys me when he talks about sort of individual relationships. He says, you know, if someone abuses you in some way, or someone like abuses your trust or does something that annoys you, tell them straight away, or, you know, they get away with it once, you kind of pass it off as a, you know, maybe it was an accident, you give them the benefit of the doubt. But if they do it again, you confront them there and then. Don't let them get away with this for like 10 years while you boil into an absolute rage, and then you just go in one day and, you know, you're going postal and you kind of like just punch them in the face or something. And he says that when he's talking to his clients as a clinical psychologist. But then when he brings that to the kind of, when he brings that into the sphere of the nation and civilization, he's like, oh yeah, no, fine. Let the leftists get away with it. You know, they're harmless. Let them kind of keep poking and prodding. You mustn't collectivize. You mustn't kind of confront them now.
But this idea that let the leftists get away with it, they're harmless, that is exactly the attitude that I think the conservative establishment took in the 1950s and 60s, and which enabled them to gain the first sort of major foothold in the universities, which enabled them to take over the universities. Conservatives are incredibly naive about this. I think this is the big difference that's come, or one of the big differences that's come with the dissident right in the last 10 years, the realization that conservatives haven't conserved anything, and it's sort of intrinsic to them that they cannot conserve anything. I mean, G.K. Chesterton said this, I think, in the 20s. So it's not like it's not a new thought, but I think it's a new realization for large numbers of people to make. The fact that conservatives are really just conserving liberalism from 5 years before, and they are not equipped. It's bizarre, really, but they're just not equipped to go on the attack. They're not equipped to actually retrieve anything that has been lost. And indeed, they can't even, in the long term, defend anything from getting lost. In the end, it's always that they're always on the coattails of their enemy, which in this case is the progressives.
Yeah, well, history is always moving, isn't it? You always need a direction to be going somewhere. And so you can't just turn the clock back 5 years and be... I think that's a lot of, that's the mentality as well of a lot of civic nationalists and centrists who say, can't we just go back to like the 70s or maybe the 80s or the 90s or something? Like, we just pick a decade and like, how do we get back there? But really you need, we are not going backwards. We are going forwards. That's the only way we can go. And so we need an actual vision for the future. We need something we can have confidence in and radicalism for, or fanaticism for.
I completely agree. We can only go forwards. We cannot go back. The left are correct when they say you can't turn back the clock, you can't preserve a culture in aspic. That's the old cliche they always come out with. And it's true. So we need a positive vision to rival their positive vision. They want to negate everything, but we can't respond to that by saying, well, let's just preserve everything. We have to say, no, let's negate this, let's negate that, and let's build this, and let's build that. It has to be something that's something, not just rejection of something else.
Yeah, and I think it's our ideas tend to be more organic on the conservative side of things. Like we like the idea of our own culture having its own roots and coming from the people. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That all cultures update. They need to update and they need to carry on. But the thing is those updates need to come from our own people with its own identity and its own sense of itself, for it to be cohesive into the future. For you to have a kind of something that's greater than the individual, to have a civilization, to have a kind of forward moving society, something with momentum that's growing. And at the moment, the problem is. Most of our cultural additions are coming not from ourselves. They're not coming from our own people. There's no updates to kind of so much of the culture now is dominated from, especially like in Europe, it's all kind of Americanized. It's all coming from immigrant cultures like that are brought into, and so that kind of stifles or crowds out the ability, I think, for our own cultural identity. But it's also because on the media and in the mainstream, the idea that we don't have an identity has become very much institutionalized. So if you ever hear a politician in the UK and increasingly around the globe in the West, they refer to our identity as just being one of tolerance and accepting people and multiculturalism. It's like an identity of being this vacuum.
I think this is one of those ideas that started in America. It's one of many ideas supporting multiculturalism that started in America, where they said the idea was created and spread that white Americans don't have a culture. That idea in itself is crazy. It's obviously not true. But it was like, you are the default. You're the unflavored variety. You're just the blank slate. Other people bring culture. You don't have one to offer. You're the paper upon which other people's paint. Now, that should have been rejected outright for as an obvious lie, because of course white Americans have culture. However, I think it was persuasive enough because a lot of American culture today, nowadays, is just consumerism, which is very hollow. So, and I don't want to caricature this, but I think a lot of what people judge themselves by is, well, I have this sofa, I wear that that shirt, I drive that car, and so on. So it is very hollow. And so it's sort of plausible to them that anything foreign is automatically a bit more deep, a bit more meaty, a bit more interesting than whatever they are, whatever they've got. So that's, I think that was established in America. It clearly was. I mean, you hear a lot of Americans say that. But then it was transplanted, like many other ideas, to Britain and other European countries. And they say that, well, Britain was boring before mass immigration, before multiculturalism. And what is British culture? It's just drinking tea. And so it becomes sort of plausible to people to think that, well, we don't have a culture, even though it's so obviously untrue and dishonest. So go on. That was a long intervention from me.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's that, like I said earlier, the culture of repudiation, this kind of, you know, that was almost a great impression of a kind of smug professor that you might hear, like, we only drink tea, you know, as if there's a certain scorn that's to be reserved for your own traditions and your own norms and cultures. But like you say, there's this idea that we are the vanilla culture, we're the default culture, and that everything else that comes in is new and adding something. But also, I think our culture in the West has, in a sense, in our institutions and our positions of political power, and particularly in academia and culture, a kind of pop culture, has been historicized. It's said, okay, that's like the end. It's that's like a dead end there. And now it's just multicultural. Now we've got to look, we have to look outside ourselves now for new cultural additions. We can't look within. We can't look into our own past and our own traditions and our own heritage and update them for the modern world as a new reborn culture. We have to look outside our own culture for kind of things that can make it better, because it's in some way fundamentally flawed. So anything we might find in our own past will necessarily be flawed because we're flawed. We have to look outside to kind of, you know, maybe if we add a bit of Indian culture to ours, then it'll kind of improve it. Or maybe if we add a bit of this or that to it, then it'll make it better. Because what we had wasn't good enough, but more than that is fundamentally flawed. And so I think there's kind of there's a kind of historicization of Western white culture in popular culture and in the media and in popular culture in the West now. And I think that's also why you have on the kind of dissident right this idealization of the aesthetics of the 70s and the kind of retro thing, because it's this period where the aesthetics were very much like, oh, we've got a kind of space age future to look forward to, the kind of colonization of the universe, and it still had the social norms and the kind of the atomic family and the family unit and all this sort of stuff, but with the hope of a kind of technologically enhanced future. And at that point you still had a culture which was drawing on its own traditions and drawing on its own kind of impetus, whereas now it's kind of, that's been historicized. And so I think that's why we often look at those aesthetics and go back there with a kind of, you know, wistful longing for that sense of a culture which still had an idea of itself perpetuating into the future.
Yeah, is the idea of strength and confidence and just not endless self-immolation.
Yeah, and just the confidence of being able to do anything. You know, this is it's something I was musing about the other day. I saw a Kuzgusak video that said it would cost, I think it was $10 billion to build a base on the moon. This is a total aside, but $10 billion to build a base on the moon. And I was like, why don't we do that? You know, we spend what, 13 or something billion on foreign aid. What a policy that would be. That's a nationalist policy. Cut the foreign aid budget and let's build a base on the moon. Like there's something that we could get behind as a nation, you know. And it's this thing of like the 60s and 70s, that kind of era where there was still this hope for a future that was of ourselves, of our own making, like a kind of like destiny. Whereas yeah. now I think postmodernism really like puts a hatchet to that and says that, you know, the only way we can add to ourselves is from outside our own cultures, and that something's missing. It wasn't good enough.
Yeah. And that's an incredibly destructive and unhealthy, poisonous thing to tell people, the thing to get them to believe that on their own, they're just not enough. There's something, as you say, on their own, there's just something wrong. They're malfunctional. They're inadequate. It's an evil thing. And I think it is generally very widespread. I cannot even imagine what is said to young English and, well, British kids at school, at high school these days, what they must be hearing in the classrooms from their teachers about on this matter. It's terrifying, really. So what else would you say about this decade? I mean, I don't know if there's any more to say about this particular thread of it. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the 2010s?
Yeah, well, I think it's sort of an era of mass red pilling, isn't it? It almost comes full circle in that the this kind of culture of listlessness that we've created has been deeply unsatisfactory for a lot of people, particularly young men, particularly young white, you know, men who see themselves constantly the target of. I mean, the main villain in our culture at the moment is the old white man, right? You know, that's like the main villain at the moment that you don't want to be. But everybody knows, you know, guys of our age know that that's what we're destined to become. So, you know, that we're the inevitable villain already. And the people that you should be most spurring on in a society, the people that kind of created the society and created the civilization and culture, that you should be, that should be kind of filling the boots of the previous generation, are actually cast as this inevitable villain just by the default characteristics of their birth. And yeah, there's a massive rebellion against that, and also against against the kind of empirical fact of grooming gangs and terror attacks and all these kind of things that are going on with increasing regularity. And people are seeing it now. So these are like the symptoms of multiculturalism. These are the symptoms of having a new left worldview. These are the symptoms of intersectionality. And it's all kind of coming to the fore and bubbling up and coming much more into the public eye now. And yeah, so you've got this mass red pilling.
Yeah, I hope so. I think something that needs to be realized is that this is not multiculturalism going wrong. This is just multiculturalism. And this is the best that you can hope for from it. And it's, in fact, as it gets more ramified, it's only going to get much worse. This is actually what we're experiencing just now, is the best era of multiculturalism. It's only going to get worse. I'm not trying to blackpill people here. Actually, it's actually a sign of hope, because I think it will force mass numbers of people to wake up. Right now, this is the best that multiculturalism will ever be. In Britain, in the West, so you know, and it's not gone wrong. This is the only way it could possibly be. So diversity and feminism, of course, you could say this about all of these leftist projects, that they can only be dysfunctional. That's not even strong enough. They can only be catastrophic for a society.
Yeah, they really are poisonous. It's like you drink the poison and then suddenly the effects come out and you notice it after a short term, and the poison's been drunk and now we're seeing the effects. But it's not just us who are seeing it. You know, I mean, there's a lot to be excited about. It's not terribly black-pilling. There's not a lot to be optimistic about, because if you think about just what's been achieved in the past, 2016 was the election of Trump. So if you think back to sort of 2015 was Brexit. Over the past half a decade, there's been such a kind of gathering of momentum in terms of a movement which is reacting to the negative consequences of everything we've been talking about. And that is building a lot of momentum. There's no denying that. And I think that's why you've got this kind of huge backlash now, where there were a lot on the left are doubling down, and they're trying to create this. They're trying to really, really push it. But it's only accelerating the response. You know, the more they try and push this stuff, and the more crazily political correct everything becomes, and the more they move from LGBT to, you know, more letters, and transgenderism becomes pushed in classrooms and things like that. You have an acceleration of the response to it. And I think now, I mean, for example, I increasingly I'm talking about these issues just with family and friends. And like I said, I used to be heavily involved in Conservative Future, which is a sort of a youth section of the Conservative Party in the UK. And everybody I know who was involved in that is very much coming to, if not on this side of thinking, then coming towards this side of thinking. And so many people that I, you know, when you, it's one of these things that's interesting. You never know quite how big the movement is because it's online and you feel kind of atomized and individualized. And then when you talk to people, often people are totally kind of not kind of the highly online people that you would find in distant right circles, perhaps, but they are coming to the same conclusions purely on the basis of the empirical evidence in front of their eyes. You know, things don't feel the same anymore.
See, this is something that I think the left would get hysterical hearing you say this, because they often, their worst fear is that even the supposedly milquetoast conservative is actually a racist. Now, that's what they say all the time. They're hysterical that everyone on the right is just secretly harboring these ideas and just skillfully hiding it. And I think that basically they're probably correct. That's not to say that these people would ever do it, necessarily enact these beliefs in any way. But I think that it probably is true to an extent. What would you say about that?
Well, the irony is that perhaps it is true, but it's a truth of their making. I mean, if you formulate a strategy to attack traditional society along ethnic lines by creating a kind of coalition of different ethnic groups and different minorities, and you use that to attack the majority and you use that to attack traditional society, then don't be surprised when the response to that attack coming from the conservative elements of society is also ethnic and kind of based along these different identity categories in nature. You know, if you formulate an identitarian attack against traditional society, then don't be surprised when the response to that attack is also identitarian. It seems kind of obvious, and it's their making. Like if you back sort of 10 years ago when I was involved in this, no one would have mentioned the total opposite to what you've just said would be true. No one would have been racist, and we'd have been offended at being called racist or, you know, homophobic or any of these names. You'd have been kind of you'd have said like, well, yeah, maybe I'm not interested in that issue, or I don't support gay marriage or whatever. But you wouldn't kind of think like, oh, you know, I'm definitely not racist. You know, like it's not really an issue I think about. Kind of, they've moved everybody from being colorblind, essentially colorblind, at least in a political sense, to being very kind of ethnically conscious, because the attacks that they're always under, because the attacks they're always coming under are from, you know, people who aren't ethnically British. You only have to look at the columnist pages of The Guardian to see stuff like that. You know, people like David Lammy, Diane Abbott, the people who always play the kind of race card and the people who are most vicious in attacking traditional British norms and society. And
Apu or Harsh would be another one, I think.
Yeah, of course. And
that awful Yasmin Alabaya Brown.
That's who I was thinking of. Yeah, the one who said she was going to leave and hasn't, sadly. I don't know how many times she's promised to leave now. I think she said she would leave if Brexit went through, and then she said she'd leave if Boris Johnson became Prime Minister. I think that's two now, and still not left. But that's always the way, isn't it?
I don't know. How can we possibly persuade her? Anyway, I mean, it's. I think you're right that the mainstream right 10 years ago were naively prepared to go along with colorblindness. They were naively prepared to say, yeah, okay, I don't see race. I don't care about race. I'm modern. But I think, because, as you say, because of the it didn't end with colorblindness, it didn't end with equality. It immediately went past that to attacking white people, attacking whiteness, attacking the white race, attacking white countries for being white. And so then the colorblind right winger has little choice but to eventually, I mean, some of them take their time, God knows, you know, talking about Douglas Murray and so on, but they eventually have no choice but to see, okay, I'm actually under attack here. It's not a social contract that's under attack. I thought it was, but actually it's me. They actually just hate me. And you know, that's a scary thing for anyone to realize. it's not the game that you're playing that you've agreed to play that the opposition are objecting to. It's you. It's actually you. That's pretty intimidating.
Yeah, and I think that's the experience people are having. They do feel attacked, and it's also the understanding. Well, there's a couple of things. So firstly, it's that feeling of being attacked, and it kind of puts you on the defensive, perhaps. But then also, it forces people to think about groups, because, you know, so one of the common cliche attacks on people, and this is the sort of thing you used to get as a conservative in, like, you know, the early 2000s or 2010s, would be when you meet people as an individual, you judge them as an individual, and the circles you tend to hang around with, you hang around with people you like, and you don't hang around with people you don't like. So if you've got lots of friends who are Indian or black or this or that, and you kind of judge them as they are, and they're nice people and whatever, and but then a leftist would say, you know, if you say, like, oh, I'm, you know, they'll call you a racist anyway, because you don't want affirmative action or something like that. So they call you a racist, and you say, I'm not a racist, I have loads of kind of friends from various backgrounds. And they go, oh right, you've got black friends, well, oh, you're, so that makes you not a racist. And you go, like, well, okay, what are you saying? The point is they kind of force you.
You can't win.
And so the left force you to think about group politics, because, you know, any normal well-adjusted person will judge people on the basis of them, you know, their social interaction with them. So you don't meet Indians as a group in your day-to-day life. You don't meet kind of the BA, you know, I don't go outside and meet the BAME ethnic voting bloc as a group all in one.
Not yet.
But you might meet one guy, and he's nice, and he's a friend, da, da, da. So when you've any normal person would just judge people as they are, you know, as an individual. But then when you're constantly being attacked, and you can see that the attacks are coming along these lines of intersectionality, then you're forced to think about group politics and the inevitable outcomes of group politics. And then you get to the kind of question of game theory. And like you said earlier, the Molyneux analogy of playing a game of football where one team only passes to themselves and the other team passes to everyone. And you go, well, actually, this isn't this isn't logical. This is I'm being an idiot here. This is a game that was set up designed for me to fail. And so, yeah, it was the left who forced everybody in society on all sides of the political spectrum to think about things in terms of intersectionality. So, like I say, if they formulate an identitarian attack on traditional Western society, then don't be surprised when the response to that is also identitarian in nature. It's kind of inevitable, really. And I think that's what that's what a lot of conservatives are kind of going through this transition, because you have no, if they're going to play the ethnic game, you have no other option than to respond along these lines, because they've kind of set the agenda in this way, which is a bit unfortunate, but I don't think you can stand back and just say, oh no, well, I appeal to, transcendent ideals and stuff like this, because these ideals are very malleable and they'll be changed, and they're not supported by the people in power. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. Okay. Are there any other aspects of the 2010s you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think the major one as well, which is another thing to be optimistic about, is just the internet and how it's kind of brought different dissident thinking and so on together across a lot of different nations. And there's a lot of comparative politics that's been enabled by that, so you can see how different groups have how different movements have worked in different countries. And like recently there was the whole thing with the Groyper Wars, and that was really interesting to watch over in the United States, and I kind of followed that a lot. You see various different nationalist leaders and things, and so it's the kind of the internet and the impact of that. I think we're only also just starting to see that, and how that kind of permeates just the ability to share things so easily. You now have people like the Iconoclast and these kind of guys who are in our circles being, you know, my mum's fiance was watches all these kinds of channels, watches like Morgoth Review, and I was just like, wow, what? Yeah. And so I think it's surprisingly large, the net that this community actually casts over into the kind of political discourse, because the political discourse is a lot narrower than the voting base. The kind of people who actually who are highly, because so many people in various nations, in all nations, are just completely apathetic when it comes to politics. There's actually quite a small number of people who are particularly interested and kind of set the tone for discussion and the direction of the discussion. And it's the people who are particularly politically interested, because then those are the people who set the social norms in, you know, around the Christmas dinner table and around amongst their family members and in offices and so on and so forth. It's always a small cohort, a kind of vanguard, ideological vanguard in society, who are the ones who are most interested in politics, who they then go out and kind of have this Kevin Bacon's 6 degrees of separation. You know, everybody knows a nationalist now by 6 degrees of separation, or everybody knows a kind of woe subscriber by 6 degrees of separation. And it's surprising how that can kind of actually permeate through society. And so I think the ability to discuss all these ideas and come together as a community, and because that's the thing that I'm noticing as well, particularly in the last 2 years, is that the ability to have this platform and discuss, because I think on the distant right, we're a lot more open to discussion and kind of honing our ideas down.
Oh, absolutely, because we're not afraid. I mean, I think we don't have anything to be afraid of, really. I mean, it sounds very cocksure, but I don't really think that there's much we can be wrong about.
There's a certain honesty to the kind of movement in that we are actually looking for answers, and we're looking, you know, if someone's got new data and they kind of blow this all out the water, then fine, I'm open to that. But on the basis of the evidence that I've looked into so far and my understanding of reality, it is what it is. And I'm very willing to back up my understanding of reality with empirical data and with the various things that the various arguments that we've been through as a kind of movement over the past 5 years. And I think we are increasingly honing down our ideas so that you've now got, you know, a wealth of economic studies into the various aspect, the various effects of on economics, and we're increasingly confident in terms of a kind of philosophy, an underlying philosophy of you know what's important to us, and a kind of anti-materialist side of things. It's like we're almost covering all our bases increasingly, and it feels like there's so many arguments now. There's a kind of certainty to the movement, perhaps, which the left just doesn't have, because it hides behind this kind of force field of political correctness.
Yes, and this is something that I've made this point several times in this millennial, that by censoring us from social media and from the mainstream media and so on, what they do is they blind themselves to our arguments and our points, and so that they can't, it means that when they don't develop an immune response to them, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like anything in life. If you train a muscle regularly, it's going to get stronger. And if you don't train a muscle regularly, it won't get stronger. And I think the left has had institutional power, particularly in academia, for a long time. And academia traditionally has been the source of a lot of kind of intellectual thinking and philosophy and that sort of thing. But now, even in terms of education, the internet is outstripping it, because you've got the access to, you know, so many videos and Wikipedia and so much information online that it's kind of out competing the academy for being the best educator. And in coinciding with that, you've also got dissident voices becoming increasingly prominent online. I mean, it's like, it's funny, after the recent election, you had, Nevada Media, which is Ash Sarkar's group. And she was saying, Ash Sarkar was saying, oh, we can't rely on the mainstream media anymore. We need to get onto alt media and stuff like that as the left. And it's like, well, go for it. You get blown the fuck out as soon as you come on like YouTube. Like, so many Guardian videos, they have to disable the comments, they disable the likes and dislikes, or they get absolutely destroyed. And it's because they've been living in this kind of bubble for so long, where like, they'll have a panel with, like I say, the kind of moderate voice is Piers Morgan, who just blusters a bit about like how he identifies as an attack helicopter or something. You know, you put the kind of joke in there. Yeah, right.
I identify as a penguin. Piers.
Yeah, it comes in with some like old 2014 meme or something about identifying as a penguin, and that's seen as like dissident. But then you've also got Ash Sarkar saying she's literally a communist, and they've been so used to being greeted by yes men at every turn in all kind of, you know, in NGOs, in everything, in teaching. If you go, oh, we need to make, you know, if you go into a kind of boardroom and say you need to make things more diverse, or you need to make things more inclusive, or you need to do this or that, and it's kind of pushing in a new left direction, you'll be welcomed with open arms. You'll be, oh yeah, we should do this, is a great initiative, let's like get some budget on it. If you were to say something of the opposite of that, if you're saying something, oh, we should make this more traditionalist, or we should, you know, make this more exclusive, we should make this more elitist, like that, you know, we should focus on quality and longevity and all the any kind of like traditional values or virtues, you'd be like, oh, well, that's a bit off. And so because they've in every walk of life been kind of pushing on an open door, their muscles, their ability to push has become very weak when it comes to actual debates. Whereas on the dissident right, the first thing you're going to get is the door slammed in your face. And if you even try to bring up these ideas, you'll be greeted with like, you're racist, sexist, homophobic, da da da. And so you kind of learn to navigate and be very good at debating. You could pick exactly what you're talking about and really dig down into things. And, you know, what's our vision for the future of society and this, that, and the other, and break things down. And you have evidence on your side and you can cite studies, and, you know, we share all these studies and things like that. So I think, yeah, that's been a huge thing in politics over the past 5 years. And over the next 10 years, I think we're going to increasingly see the effects of that, because you can't hide from, as much as the postmodernist left is kind of almost anti-logic. If you read kind of postmodernist writing in academia, it's coated in this level of verbose language that makes it almost unreadable. And the point is that it's not meant to be understood or read. It's meant to be just put in there into academia so that it can't be challenged. It's written in this certain language that can't be challenged.
It's just verbiage. It's just, yeah. It's supposed to drown the middle IQ, 100 to 120 sort of student. It's supposed to drown them and intimidate them into just, well, acquiescing.
Yeah, I mean, but even if you're, you know, Roger Scruton or something, who's doing a treatment of one of these papers from the postmodernist left, would just say, this is nonsense. Essentially, the English makes no sense. And there's so much additional language that comes from this kind of culture of postmodernism. It's all in references. And the entire purpose of it is not to make the writing more clear or add clarity. It's to actually obfuscate. And the point of obfuscating is because if you obfuscate enough, you can't actually be challenged.
It's the
no
very
one can
opposite.
Challenge you because no one knows what you're saying.
Yeah, it's the very opposite of what academia is supposed to be about. Like, in theory, academia is about truth seeking and bringing order out of the chaos of reality and simplifying almost, but not in a dishonest way. It's supposed to be truth seeking, and yet so much of it today is the very opposite. It's how to obfuscate, how to lie, how to obliterate. It's just utterly philistine. But anyway, are there any other points you'd like to make?
Not particularly. I was just gonna say I'm pretty optimistic, I think, for the next 10 years.
Yes,
I think,
actually, before we do that, let's do the super chat. So if anyone does have questions, you can post them in here, because there are a few already, so we can occupy you with that, and then we'll get to the white pills at the end, so, because it's nice to end with that, I think.
All right so
immigrants who don't assimilate, this is apparently a quote from Winston Churchill, although I've never heard it before. Immigrants who don't assimilate into their new country are troublesome. Immigrants who do successfully integrate are even worse. Well, you know, I'm no fan of
based
Churchill, but that is indeed based. Somebody's asked, Toroidal is asking me to ask Sargon a question. What if your ideas and thoughts are wrong? What if your values are wrong? Sargon, I'm can't speak for him, but I'm pretty sure he would just say, well, they're not wrong. They've been tested, and hundreds of years of development and so on. So
yeah, what do you mean wrong? Right. John Locke wrote it, please.
Yes. All right. Does it matter if Britain was or wasn't ever an ethnostate? This is similar to the sunk cost fallacy. Who cares? Isn't the real question, should Britain become a non-white nation where Brits become a minority? Yeah. Yeah, I of course, I was just addressing the thing that people say, that Britain's never been an ethnostate. You know, because it, as if that is relevant, because that's the whole point. It's not relevant. It never has been an ethnostate because it never needed to be. That's the point. All right. Do you think George W. Bush delayed the rise of the new left in America by a decade? It seems like Al Gore was a Tony Blair type liberal. Both are baby boomers, too. Al Gore popularized global warming as well. Now, what would you say to that? Did George W. Bush delay the rise of the new left by a decade?
Yeah, in America. Interesting question, actually, because I was thinking about this, because having thought of the kind of narrative in time that we've had in Britain with Blair coming in 97, I thought if you translate that over to the United States, really, for them, it would have been the Obama era more. So, yeah, lines up almost exactly a decade. I mean, Rules for Radicals, Saul Alinsky, he described himself as a community organizer, and it said that the kind of Obama era, 2008 onward, Obama also described himself as a community organizer, and it's this kind of war of the have-nots against the haves. But when you put that onto a global scale, it ends up of a war of everybody against the West, instigated by the people running the West, which is, you know, not the best for us. George Bush. Well, I think the other thing about George Bush is that he's another example of a kind of the kind of capture of the real right by the fake right, in that it's neoconservatism. So, like, in my mind, George Bush's presidency is primarily represented by fighting wars in the Middle East that weren't necessarily, you know, for the benefit of the United States, and they're still there. So it's a kind of neocon presidency, in my view. And neoconservatism, to me, is an ideology entirely oriented around surrendering to the left on domestic ideological policy and focusing entirely on international relations and international policy. But it kind of it's very hard to see sometimes what the difference is between neoconservatism and neoliberalism. There is a difference if you kind of dig into it, but I think they kind of, looking back, they neoconservatism ends up being the armed forces for neoliberal ideology in a sense.
Yeah, I think that in effect the difference is pretty null and void. I mean, one ends up enabling the other.
Yeah, like neoconservatism is just the belief that you should impose on other countries around the world the pre-existing paradigm of neoliberalism which you have in the West. So, yeah.
Yeah. Hold on a second. Just let me deal with this. Right. There aren't any more questions. That's surprising. I was hoping that people would have more questions for Libertas Metapolitics. So I'll just post the link again, just in case anyone's missing it. Okay, so let's move on to white pills. Why are you hopeful for the future, for the 2020s? What do you expect to happen in the 2020s?
Well, and this is kind of related to what I was talking about on the just now about us being online and creating a community, is I think we need to, on the right, embrace kind of political Darwinism so that the strongest ideas survive, and we kind of use what works, keep what works, and abandon what doesn't. And I think that's been the story of the last 5 years of the distant right being very dynamic and adapting to what's working and not adapting to what's not working. And that's totally opposite to how the left operates.
It does feel like a survival drive. It feels like, okay, let's quickly work out what we need to do to what arguments we need to do in order to survive. It feels, as you say, extremely dynamic.
Yeah, I think I'm sure I've heard in one of your speeches before you referring to this movement as a kind of autoimmune response to yeah.
That wasn't me though. That was me quoting someone else describing the alt-right.
Okay, yeah. Well, it does. And like I said at the beginning, it's like the rise of existential politics. So it's like the stakes are higher now because what's under threat, you know, if you really take to heart the culture of repudiation that I've been talking about, if any civilization really takes that to heart, it's taking its own suicide to heart. Like, it cannot survive. And so what we're on is really a mission to save our own civilizations. And that does seem to be higher stakes than everything we've had before. And like I was saying, for the next 10 years, we need to stick to this kind of political Darwinism and being dynamic, adapting to what's working. And yeah, we will outdo the left if that happens. The only thing is supplanting the right. Because, I mean, at the moment, for example, we've got Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, and they're not reflecting at all on the reasons for why they lost. If you look at their selection at the moment for party leaders, we've got, looking forward, so looking forward into the next 10 years, I think we could potentially have, another 10 years of Conservative government. And so it may be the case that actually the real dissident response to the current paradigm that we're in is it comes from the left. Because the Conservatives have been in for so long that the next party, and this is based on this book called The Cameron Delusion by Peter Hitchens. And what he was saying was in 2010, when the Labour Party were about to win another election, it would win its fourth consecutive election, putting it in for however long, and the Conservatives were increasingly on their back foot. And he was saying the Conservative Party has failed to make any kind of serious conservative ideological push against this new Labour attack. And so what he was hoping was that the Conservatives would lose another fourth consecutive election and essentially die as a party, and therefore creating space on the right wing for a new, more virile movement, which would actually have a kind of coherent right wing ideology and a vision for the future, rather than being kind of ultra react, well, rather than just kind of going along at a lower speed limit. And so what I think is perhaps the opportunity over the next 10 years might be that we see that from the left, in that the Labour Party collapses and you end up with a kind of more nationalist left-wing party pitted against the neoliberal Conservative Party. I think that could have some potential. And I say that because it's quite clear that the Labour Party is learning nothing from the recent election. They seem to be completely content on going down this road of intersectionalism. So if you look at the lineup, they've got what David Lammy is in the running. They've got Jess Phillips. They've got like all the, and I'm sure the next leader of the Labour Party is probably going to be a strong independent woman like Jess Phillips, who just goes even further down this kind of intersectional line. And it just seems like they're so stuck in this spiral.
So even after this crushing defeat, they still can't reflect. They can't afford to reflect. Why do you think that is? Well, as you said, I think you were just about to say it. Go for it.
Well, I mean, I suppose there was a phrase, I can't remember who I heard this off, but it's like the left are in danger of creating, because they've got this cancel culture and this like attack anybody who steps out of line, the purity spiral. They're in danger of ending up with this kind of circular firing squad, where they just all shoot each other and anybody who steps out of line, because it's so anti-change, because they create this really rigid kind of language policing structure where no one can say anything that's out of line. It hampers the evolution of their entire political movement so that it can't keep up with the changing realities. So maybe back in 1997, they thought having a diverse range of kebab shops would be brilliant and that would work out and we'd all be much happier. But now that people aren't, and that they've lost their working class base in the north, they don't seem to be able to respond to that, because they've spent the last 10, 20 years constructing this incredibly rigid system to punish anybody who deviates from their ideological doctrine. And so they're fully geared in now, and you see it in the next, I'd be very interested to see what comes out of that, but I can only expect they'll have someone like David Lammy or Jess Phillips or something leading the party. I don't see really any candidates up there that would constitute to me a realistic response to the crushing defeat they've just had and the rejection of this kind of far left SJW stuff that they keep pushing. If you look at the Labour manifesto, it's like a SJW's wet dream. So they haven't, that's been thoroughly rejected, particularly among their base, and they don't seem to be learning anything from it. So then if they don't learn anything from it and they go into another general election and they lose again, I mean, how many years of Conservative government will it take, and how many years of Labour opposition will it take to realise that that party is totally not fit for purpose? It's not an opposition. It's not holding the government to account. Because that's the whole point, is that they should be there to hold the government to account and to account and make sure that we're not just stuck in a kind of conservative in name only kind of sell out to corporations. And just the whole conservative mantra for the past 10 years has been this kind of steady hand on the rudder. We'll just keep things going as they are. We don't have a particular vision. We'll just let the country be ruled by corporations and all the rest of it. And Labour are meant to present a coherent opposition to that and a viable opposition to that, but they just aren't. They keep losing elections and they keep not learning from their mistakes. And now they're going to seemingly do that for another 5, 10, 15, how many years? I don't know. But surely at some point you've got to say the Labour Party isn't fit for purpose. There needs to be, they're going to die. If they can't win an election, they've got to die, because people will stop joining the Labour Party. You know, the politicians join these parties because they want to get elected. And you've got people losing their seats left, right and centre to Conservatives. I think I saw a tweet the other day, which was from a local Labour group, and someone had tweeted a picture of their election results, and one of their tabs, they'd accidentally caught one of their tabs, which was open, and it was a join the Conservative Party tab. So it was a Labour person that had been looking to join the Conservative Party after a crushing defeat. And that's exactly, you know, the kind of career politician doesn't want to be in a party that was never going to offer him a position in office. And the Conservative Party are very good at getting people into office. And so if the Labour Party dies because it doesn't have politicians who want to join it because they know that they're not going to have any success, then inevitably there's got to be something else that comes in there. So I'm optimistic about this patriotic alternative thing that Mark Collette's organising. I'm interested to see where that goes. But yeah, I see the Labour Party is going to completely collapse.
But isn't there a danger that if the Labour Party does completely collapse, it will be... Well, first of all, I think it will be supported by the minorities, the ethnic minorities. I think it will not ever... I wouldn't be surprised if it never regains the white working class. I think that's probably what's going to happen. It's not ever going to regain the white working class, but it could well become the party of ethnic minorities. And that might eventually become a sufficient block to get them into office. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a dead party or a doomed party. You know, what would you say about that?
Well, I mean, they could keep the structures there and they could turn into the kind of BAME block party. But the name and everything, their whole history has been the party of the working class and the kind of, in the name, the Labour Party, the party of the labourer. And so I think, you can scarcely say that it's the same party when the labourer has completely abandoned them in places that were traditionally their kind of absolute true red constituencies. And so, is it the same party? I don't know. It's like that ship of Theseus thing. Like, at what point did the Labour Party stop becoming the Labour Party when you've replaced its entire base? You know, the base no longer, the base is no longer, I mean, I suppose that extends to the entire country, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed. Okay, we've got a new two more questions and then we'll call it a day. Just a thought, if we never had the internet, would we have been completely screwed? The Liberal elite would have had complete control over the entire narrative. Scary to think about.
Yeah, well, it's possible because, and I think that's the thing that the internet offers, is because there's this kind of scary mechanism that's shown in the Robert Putnam study, is that when you get large immigration come into a community from the outside, it creates distrust and it kind of has this damaging effect on social cohesion and civic health. And so people atomize. I think the term he uses in the paper is people hunker down, and you get people watching, time watching TV goes up and all this sort of stuff. And so it's interesting in the way that because it's happened at the same time as technology has moved away from TV and towards people consuming media online and so forth, people have hunkered down, gone online, ended up on polls, become red-pilled, and formulated a community to respond to the thing that forced them online in the first place. You know, the thing that's removed people from the community, that's kind of atomized people and broken up communities, is the very thing that forced them online, which they're now rebelling against. I don't know what you think about that as a kind of...
Well, I think it's... See, my issue is I don't know how many people are reading 4chan, how many people are watching these videos on YouTube and BitChute. So I don't know how much of a fraction we're talking about yet. That's the so it's difficult for me to make any sort of pronouncements about it. I don't want to be too confident, you know, and then get disappointed.
Yeah, I think on the one hand, small groups of people do tend to control the narrative on these things because they, you know, especially on the internet, it's like I'd imagine people involved in this movement are a fairly standard sample across the country, you know, from all different areas, all different people doing all different kinds of jobs and stuff. So they get into all walks of life and kind of red pill other people and talk to their friends and kind of raise these questions. So there is that element to it, but also I don't think, you know, it's not just the internet, for example, it's not just the internet, because the things that we are complaining about are real. They exist and they are apparent to people when you go and walk down the street. It's becoming more and more obvious to people that something is fundamentally changing in our country. And if you go to places that you used to go to, they look less and less recognizable. You know, you hear English spoken less and less when you go and walk around town. And that's something that people have to notice at one point or another, whether they go and research that online or whether they, you know, I mean, it's not like people have never been outside and then they happen across Twitter and see a kind of some video and go, oh, wow, this is really shocking. A lot of the time, that explains what's happening to them, perhaps, but they've already been to London. They've already kind of seen the representation. They see these adverts that are on TV all the time. They see the kind of representation in the media. They see the various headlines, the kind of anti-white, anti-Western, anti-male, anti-traditional, anti-family narratives that are constantly pushed. They still see all that stuff and they still resent it. It's just that... yeah, I suppose the internet has become an area where people can vent about it and then organize some kind of response to it.
Well, indeed. I think that this links to something that people often see. There's a question of what can I do to help the movement and our ideas and so on. And the answer is talk about these things with people in your real life. Because as you've said, a lot of folk aren't going to find, you know, Morgoth's channel or Mark Collett or whatever. So it's a good idea to just spread these ideas. Obviously, you've got to be careful and not to endanger yourself legally or in terms of your employment. But yeah, I think it's really, this is, as someone said, it is a matter of, it's very important. Let me just say that the stakes are high and this really does matter. So try to talk to people in your real life about this. So, okay, any final thoughts, Libertas Metapolitics?
I was just going to give some book recommendations. I suppose this is my favourite books and books I'd recommend. People will probably have some reading time around this time of year. So, funnily enough, as we talked about Douglas Murray, even though he's not your favourite, Stranger Death of Europe definitely is a kind of... great starting place. Exodus by Paul Collier, I think, is also really good for anybody who wants arguments around immigration. And then for in the British context, I think Abolition of Britain by Peter Hitchens and The Cameron Delusion by Peter Hitchens give a really nice narrative of kind of how things have changed in the UK. And then as an esoteric one, one I read earlier this year was The Age of Nihilism by Curtis R. McManus. And that was actually released this year and had very few reviews on Amazon. So I think it might be kind of a bit of an esoteric publisher. I'm not sure, but it was in my Amazon recommendations and it was an absolutely brilliant book, The Age of Nihilism.
Right. Okay. All right. Oh, two more questions. Aren't the non-whites the new Labour working class? Yes, that was the point earlier. There are brilliant people on the right. How can we get them to take more initiative, building businesses and creating culture, such as books, music, and so on? How can we motivate them, the brilliant people on the right? So let's hear your question, your answer to that, and then we'll sign off.
Well, I think the right in general, the whole kind of right-wing ethos tends to be one of responsibility and traditionalism. And I don't know that it's necessary. Yeah, I think we do a good job of motivating people, especially if you look at channels like The Golden One and people like that. I think there's a kind of culture that we've established on the right as well, not just to discussing these ideas, but actually trying to bring people up and make individuals strong enough to go out and achieve things in their lives. So I think that's what's good about this movement and this ideology, actually, is that it gives you something outside of yourself to work for. I think, for example, a lot of people got interested in Jordan Peterson and a lot of the kind of self-help type messaging that he gave and the idea of taking on responsibility and things like that. And that's great. But then there's no greater good that he offers. There's nothing to work towards as a community. And I think people often need that as well. So how to motivate people? I'd just say, yeah, go ahead. You can do it. Start small. Everything's achieved with small steps. And go for it. Do it.
All right. Okay, that was Libertas Metapolitics. I'll be back soon. Excuse me, I'm tripping over my words here. I'll be back soon with Black Pilled. In the meantime, Libertas Metapolitics, thank you for taking part in Millennial 2019.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Okay, I'll see you all in about 10 minutes. Bye for now.